Hiya, Wanju. Hello. Welcome to another episode of The Curb. I'm Andrew F. Pierce, and this is the podcast where I bring you in-depth interviews with filmmakers, creatives, and curators of culture. This podcast is recorded in Boorloo, Western Australia, sovereignty never ceded. Saskia Archer is an actor on the rise. From the streets of Sydney to the turf of Tasmania, where she embarked on a path to become a paramedic, to a shift to WA, where she built her acting skills at the WA Academy of Performing Arts, WAPA. And now to the bustling city of New York. Saskia is seeing the world and forging a path in acting doing so. Genre fans might know her from the 2022 flick The Reef Stalked, where she played Annie, while others might know her as her turn as Hannabeth in Bali 2022. For these roles and more to come, including a turn in Shane Black's upcoming film Play Dirty, Saskia leans on her foundations as an empathy-first actor, utilising her skills to change audiences' mood and emotions. In the following interview, Saskia talks through her path into acting, what kinds of roles and actors she looks up to, how her initial training as a paramedic informs her acting work, and a whole lot more. If you want to find out more about what we do on The Curb, then head over to thecurb.com.au. We're a completely independent and ad-free website that lives on the support of listeners and readers just like yourself. For an exclusive unedited version of this interview as well, visit patreon.com/thecurbau, where you can support us from as little as a dollar a month. Right, here's my chat with Saskia Archer. Well, let's kick off then by exploring where you started, like what your interest in acting. Where did that kick off? What was the thing that you went, yeah, this is for me?
Took me into it.
Yeah.
I fell into it completely by accident. I had a friend who pushed me to audition for WAPA, and at that time he was already at WAPA, and I had heard all these stories through him, but I was like, it sounds a bit. Like, acting's not for me. At that point in time, I just finished high school and I was studying to be a paramedic in UTAS, in Tasmania. I grew up in Sydney. So I was, like, doing a completely different thing. But then he was like, I just really think you'd be great for it. And so he actually submitted my application for me and paid for it. And he was like, I just really think you should do it. And I was like, this is ridiculous. And I, out of guilt and, like, obligation, I was like, I better just do it. And I did it and I had so much fun. And I was like, oh, hold on. What the hell is this? This is so much fun. This is not what I thought it was going to be. I don't know exactly what I thought, but I had a lot of fun in that process. And also WAPA conducts their audition process in a really fun way. And even though there's so many people going for it, 700 to 1,000 on average per year, you're like, there's no way I'm going to get in. And because the 9 boys, 9 girls per year group get in. And then when they made me that offer, I had to scratch my head and go, do I walk away from paramedics and try this thing that I don't really understand? And I was like, well, if there's a time to do it, it's now. I think I was 19, 20, and it was like, that's the right time to give it a go. So I thought, I'll go give it a go, and then, it won't work out, so I'll go back to paramedics. But then, of course, I got started, and I was like, oh, my God. This is touching and illuminating something part of the human spirit that I just didn't have access to in the medicine world. And interestingly, I think that's why I was interested in the medicine world, because I wanted to help people. I wanted to have that juice of why the hell we're alive and what is meaningful to us. And when as soon as you start collaborating on art and talking about art in that way, you're talking about humanity. And my soul started to fire, and you get that energy from deep within you. And I was like, I can't go back. This is amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. So, right. So you're from Sydney, you go down to Tasmania, you start doing a paramedic stuff, and then you end up in Western Australia. Like, they're two very remote places, very different from Sydney and the chaos of Sydney as well. What was going through your head? First of all, Tasmania and then Western Australia.
You touched on something already, and my instinct is that you know.
Yeah.
It's the chaos of Sydney is why I left and why I was eager to leave. I had an awful experience in high school. I was, like, quite a troubled teenager. And I just wanted to get out of there. So as soon as I turned 18, I finished high school. I got a great enough ATAR that I got into what I wanted to go. And so I got to choose where I wanted to go. I was like, I'm going to Tassie. It's far away. It's removed. I have no idea what's there. Great recipe.
Yeah.
And that kind of like impulsive courage, I think, kind of speaks to my personality. Like I'll make the jump and I'll figure it out in the jump. Mm. Because I know that if I pre-figure it out, the jump won't happen. Because, you know, the logic will take charge, and there's always going to be reasons not to do things. But then Perth was a completely different experience, and I'm so glad that I lived in Perth. It's got to be one of the best places in the world, because, you know, and as a artsy person, I'm guessing you are and have been your whole life, you're going to have a lot of ideas, complexities, things going on internally.
Yeah.
So you have the chaos. And it's a wonderful artistic chaos that like makes us so interesting. And when I was internally chaotic in somewhere like Sydney, which is externally chaotic, it was overwhelming and not in an inspiring way. And so finding myself in Perth, I was like, I had my creative chaos, but it was able to expand and apply it. And I love that. So I'm jealous of you. You're there. Yeah.
Well, that's good. I mean, it's really nice to hear positive things about Perth. You know, we people who live in Perth tend to be down on it often enough that it's nice to hear somebody else outside of Perth say nice things about it. But as we're talking about, like, you're in New York at the moment, and what I found about being in New York is that the chaos of New York actually gives way to a creativity and an introspection, which I didn't expect. Like, I remember before I even went there, seeing all these people there, and I'm like, oh shit, I'm just going to get lost in all this. I'm just going to get swallowed whole. But instead, like, the people watching, right? What's your experience then like being there?
You've touched on something that I've been thinking about a lot. So perhaps we can brainstorm together and figure out what it is exactly. I have theories. And my theories is that the chaos in Sydney, I'm just going to use that as, you know, the metric of the external chaos in Australia that exists there versus New York. But for me, it's superficial chaos. Mm-hmm. It's like it's the beeping and, you know, the traffic and the organization just geographically. It's people kind of reactively existing amongst each other. And it's this superficial external chaos. And yes, that exists within New York, but you also have the whole other spectrum of chaos too. Like, you have so many creative people and external people like expats coming to New York to be creative. So whilst there's that metric of external chaos, there's also everything else. And I think because there's the balance, you're able to see the nuance, the complexity, and it's kind of a concentrated form of humanity.
Yeah.
And so when you're living there in that moment, you're going, oh, there's so much going on. There's so much to execute. There's so much to think and talk about. Versus if I, you know, teleport to Sydney and I'm like, oh, there's only the external chaos to execute, observe, and interact with.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense completely. All right. So I'll tell you about something which I find really fascinating. You might know about this, you might not, but in Times Square, like, I've told so many people about this because I find this the most fascinating thing. And it's actually quite a centralizing thing that I found when I went to Times Square. So in Times Square, there's this thing called the Times Square Hum, which was created by Max Niehaus. And that was back in 1977, he created it. And then it's been around for a while. And basically what it is, it's not a physical thing that you go and see, but it's this sound that you stand over this grate and there's this sound that emanates from underneath this grate. And in the chaos of all of Times Square, you go and stand on this grate and suddenly everything gets drowned out and all you're hearing is just the hum. It's the most bizarre feeling, right? And it is a fascinating thing because it's kind of what you're saying, like, it's these layers of creativity that are in New York and this chaos and all this kind of stuff. And yet you're able to centralize yourself in a way that you're able to go, ah, this is it. This is who I am. Which, you know, it's a fascinating thing. And as a creative person, you need that. You need that central point of being able to go, this is who I am. So guiding that kind of diatribe into a question, what was there a point where you go, you realize this is who I am as an actor, this is what I need to be?
I think the change came in when I did a play called When the Rain Stops Falling. It's a play called When the Rain Stops Falling. It's by Andrew Bovell, and it touched on the core themes of humanity. There was, little things of climate change and the way that we progress as a world over generations and the way that generations impact each other. And it was so simple. It was a really simple play, but the complexity and the depth and the way that it expanded my mind, thinking generationally, thinking the way that our psychoanalytics, we interact with each other in ways that we consciously understand and ways that we don't. I was like, oh, this is so much more complex and nuanced and interesting and will change as I age. And I think I'll understand it more as I age. I was like, this is a lifetime venture that I want to go on. And there is no answer. The answer is the experience of it. And I was like, that's what I want. I want that. What does it mean to be human? I want the light in the dark. I want the to comfort the disturbed and disturb the comfortable. I want that. And when I compared it to going back to paramedics, paramedics became just about extending people's lives, not about tapping into the nuance and why in which we live meaningful, challenging, interesting human lives. And one is just more interesting to me.
Yeah, it's understandable. And look, there's always the chance as well, like medical stuff is a huge thing on screen. I mean, we look at what
It's true.
look at what Shabana Aziz is doing with The Pit, right? An Australian who's doing work there. So there's always that path where it might marry up in the future.
Which could be cool.
It would be really cool. Yeah, especially like, I mean, not to go on a sidestep for a moment, but the special effects and the VFX for The Pit at the moment, it was really, really fascinating. So it's almost like that real life aspect of actually dealing with it. But when you see fellow actors like Shabana, who are making a career for themselves in America, what does that mean for you as an emerging talent to know that your fellow Australian actors are doing, pushing hard into really interesting ways?
I find it hugely inspiring. I love seeing, there's two different ways you can look at it, which is that people that are similar than you doing things means that there's less out there for you. I don't buy into that. That just proves my theory that it's one possible and two possible for me. So seeing that and seeing Australians go get their success, I'm like, yeah. That's why I'm here. This is why I'm in New York. It is possible. Like, absolutely, it's possible. So it just means that I'm on the right track. That's what it looks like to me. And inspiring.
Yeah, which is good. But let's talk about the reef as well, because I understand that the way that you ended up on the reef was a bit interesting. Can you talk about your journey into being on the reef stalked?
Yeah, so the reef stalked came at a time, probably one of the worst weeks of my life, no question. I was living in a home that wasn't particularly safe. I was, sharing a wall with a group of people who were making and dealing meth and crack. And I ended up being a registered saucer with the police. Don't worry, that's over now, so I can talk about it. And I had to go to the private investigator every day and talk about what I've seen and what they've been doing and what kind of dealers might have turned up. I exchanged photos. It was just insane. The smell of the drugs was like overpowering. I had a mask in my room. They had a dog that was really violent. So I wasn't sleeping. I was like very shaky. And the question of why didn't I move out? I didn't have a place to go to. And I also thought that they'll be kicked out in 2 seconds. I didn't realize that the process was going to be so dragged out and the police needed so much from me before they could actually do anything to help me. So I ended up moving out within this week. And then I had a family member had heart surgery out of the blue. He's fine now. And then I had a serious relationship end all within the same week. And I I was like, I haven't slept. I feel absolutely delusional. I had no hope. I was just sitting in that spot where you're like, oh, this is as what the worst as it gets. You know, you lose your support system. Going through a breakup alone sucks, but like going through all of it at the same time was the worst. And then I got a call from my agent, like, oh, you've booked the Reef and they're going to fly you up within 3 days. Are you going to be ready to fly out on Monday? It's Friday. I was like, what? What do you mean I booked what? Because also with acting, like you do an audition months ago and then you only hear about it. You can hear it months, weeks later. I forget because I do so many auditions and things happen. And it took me so long to process it. And after about an hour, I then call my friends. I'm like, guys, I think I booked a job. And they're like, what do you mean you think? And I was like, well, I got a call from my agent. And they're like, so you did? I was like, yeah, I guess. And then I literally got flown up to the Northern Australia and we got thrown straight into rehearsals and getting ready, physically ready for the roles because it was so physically demanding. And then we just jumped straight into filming once we were prepared.
Yeah. So imagine you go through a week like that. You've already had some preparation as, you know, learning and understanding what being a paramedic is like as well. These are all understanding aspects of trauma and the impact that it has on your physical being, but also your mental being. And then you're doing like the Reef Stalked, which is, you know, trauma is an aspect
trauma.
To it. Yep. And then Bali 2002 as well, which has its own aspect of trauma too. How do you feel that your own experience of trauma helped inform what you went through with the Reef and Bali as well?
Great question. My experience of trauma definitely has informed my acting because I don't really have to go anywhere to access it. It's like always within me. So I find it, what I love about acting is like when I'm in my everyday life, you don't really have permission to access those darker parts of yourself. But as soon as that camera is rolling, I can get as dark and dirty and gritty as I want because the director can always pull me back. And if they see how far I could go, then they know what's out there. So I love that aspect. And I feel like acting has given me a permission to explore the trauma that, you know, sits with me because of those past experiences. And having that and the melding pot between, and if you've experienced trauma, which, you know, most of us have, unfortunately, at this stage, it's that there's a fear aspect to it. There's a grief aspect to it. There's the unknowing and this deep residing pain. And it all comes through, but they move at different paces. So while I'm doing a scene, they're all coming and changing and shifting. So in one word can be more grief driven. And then the next one will be completely motivated by fear. And going through that in as Annie in The Reef Stalked hugely informed my performance because, you know, there was one moment where one of the characters gets taken and I watch her die in front of me, pretty traumatic. And you go through all of the emotions at the same time, the grief and the fear and what's going on, and I'm confused but I'm scared for myself as well, and you have these clashing forces every single moment, and then it explodes in either a yell, a cry, a scream, a something, an action, a word. And I'm so grateful in a way that I have those memories to inform those acting scenes, because I know and I can feel when I'm connected to that because it reads on screen.
Yeah. And how do you safely get yourself out of it then? Like, because the cut doesn't always help, does it?
Yes, you're so right. And if I'm not careful, I can stay in that state, you know, when you're feeling those deep emotions and tapping into trauma of any kind. It doesn't, because it's in the body, you can't expect it to go like that. If it's real, it's not going to go uncut, in my opinion. And my experience. So what happens is, like, there's this one scene where I was screaming and crying because I watched someone die in front of me, and they called cut, and I just kept screaming and crying, not for the camera, but because there was emotion to still process. And I consciously was like, okay, this isn't real, and let the cry continue and soften and go out. And then I shake and I shake because apparently that's a nervous system regulation technique. And so I just do it. I do that. I have some sugar. I play a song. And then I'm like, oh, that was a lot. And, you know, and so I remember seeing the continuity lady holding her thing with her, with just crying from the scene. I was like, oh my God, are you okay? And then I became Sasuke again and we're talking and then she's becoming her again. And we're like, okay, it's really the story. Okay, this is a great story. Awesome. And we have that process together to let it go and having wonderful directors that know that that's could be what happens in the really intense scenes means that I can transition out of it in a really healthy and actually quicker way.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, these are things as you like, you do more projects as well, you find ways of dealing with it for that specific project. So I'm curious then for you going forward as an actress, what are you looking forward to doing? Like, these are heavy things, you know, watching friends die in front of you, that kind of stuff is heavy stuff. Understandably, it's not probably what you want to be doing all the time. So what kind of work do you want to do?
I'd like to do continually explore drama nuance of those complex female leads outside of death, you know, take away the action, the horror, the like external kind of trauma and explore more the internal trauma, because I think that's something that's far harder to explore, you know, as human beings where like life is weird and painful. And I want to explore that on screen more isolated. How do we navigate those parts of ourselves that are good and bad, and how do they interact, and how do I justify the actions that I take, especially villains? I would love to play a very real, not like horror villain, but like just not a great person, and how they or she rather justifies her actions. That would be fascinating. Because tapping into the villain and like not trying to be good or justifying how you're doing bad things, I think, you know, it touches on the parts of ourselves we could be if we let ourselves go there.
Yeah.
You know, I remember I had a coach and a mentor called Donald Woodburn who said like we all have the evil person inside of us, and you have to acknowledge that in your acting. You have to be aware of it, pretending that you're not that is bullshit. And he's like, don't bullshit me, don't fucking bullshit me. And you're like, okay, I suck and I'm great and I'm interesting and I'm not interesting, and it's all there at the same time.
Yeah, and that's really complicated, isn't it? Yeah, it's hard.
Yeah,
like, and it's also it's about, I guess, I mean, acting is a bit about indulging that side, you know, indulging that dark person who exists within us all, but also knowing when to pull back too. You're talking about villainous women. Are there any particular characters or actors who you've seen that you're like, gosh, that's an inspiration, or I'd really like to be able to tackle something specifically like that?
I mean, Cate Blanchett has done some interesting villains before, and her as an Australian female actor is always inspiring to me. And the way that she navigates that with softness, I think, is really interesting. Like, how do you softly approach a villain? But honestly, it's the opposites that usually attract. Like, you have a villain doing a really fucked up thing, but they speak very softly about it because they don't really care. It's like more powerful and it hurts a little bit more versus the villain that really cares and is really vindictive. So she comes to mind, but I haven't found, I tend to think less so about actors and more so about a specific roles, and I haven't seen a villain too much, you know. I liked the darker side in Black Swan of herself.
Yeah,
I liked that kind of villain. Is interesting to me, I guess, psychological thriller villains. And I liked the nuance of Olivia Colman in The Favourite and how she was kind of a bad guy. But they're not exactly what I envision for myself. Maybe more so a melding pot between an evil version of Lara Croft, say, and Cate Blanchett evil and Olivia Colman. They're completely different worlds. So I don't have an answer.
Well, when you find it, you'll be able to tap into it and it'll be your creation. But, are you going to continue on working in America, trying to build up a career there?
For the time being, that's where I'll be based. But now with the globalization and the way that we are in the world, like I'm doing auditions in Europe that are filming in Europe, in Budapest, Atlanta, in LA, in Sydney, in Perth, in Melbourne. There's constant auditions all over the world. So I really don't know where I'll be next. I tend not to get attached to, offers and things that come through until I'm signing something. Which makes sense.
Yep.
And until that happens, I don't really know exactly where I'll be hopping to and then where I'll hop to after that. But going between New York and Sydney as my bases is ideal for me, I think.
And I mean, as you're saying, like you grew up on watching the French classics and the New Wave and stuff like that. There's so much to learn from that, and there's such a deep, deep, deep well to pull from as well, and just get lost in. Is there, like you mentioned, Cleo 5 to 7. Are there any other kinds of films in that era that you?
Vagabond. Vagabond was fascinating. Rather, the first one that I saw, which I think is a classic, maybe it's a pipeline of all the filmmakers and film creators, which is Blue is the Warmest Color. That was the first one that I'd seen in the French world, European world, that I realized did something different than the American and most of the Australian film industry. And it was from there that I started exploring. But the ones that come straight to mind would be Vagabond, Cleo 5 to 7. I watched Both Sides of the Blade by Claire Denis recently. My last summer. What are these? There's another one about a summer that came out. It was in the French Film Festival last year, but it was about a stepmother and her stepson.
Last
That one
summer.
was really interesting to me because, it's disturbing. But watching it and then watching the interviews of Catherine talking about it, and she said, I've gotten so much criticism, people going, why are you telling this story? Are you trying to make a comment on this or that? She goes, I'm not trying to comment on anything. I'm just saying a story, and it's your job to comment with your interpretation and how you feel about it. I'm just showing it. And I thought that that was a really interesting detachment from the story because in more Western American Australian, we go, what are we trying to say? What's our meaning? And I think what the French seem to be doing, if from observing a lot of the patterns, is that they're not trying to say something. They're just showing a particular side of something. And then with that, we interpret it. And because they're not trying to push a point or push a message or push a something, that's, I think, why so much of us in the industry gravitate towards that for inspiration, because it's not pinpointed. It's open, it's nuanced, there's something complex there, but at the same time refined. And we're finding a way to do that in Western, in Australia and America, whilst making it commercial so that it can have success and funding. And I think that's a really hard mixing spot.
Oh, it really is, isn't it? And I've talked to so many Australian directors who used to chase the American market, but now they're looking for the European market. And the style of film that is getting made in Australia or with Australian creatives is really changing because of exactly what you're saying. They're just presenting a story and letting it be the story, and the audience bring their own prejudices, expectations, assessments, whatever to it. And I know I've had conversations with directors who, and I've been like, so when you did this, what did you think? I think that you meant that. And they were like, that's fascinating. You thought that. I didn't think this at all. It's like, and I sit there and I'm like, okay, cool, that's fine. But that's the power of cinema, right? And it's the power of being able to actually have that kind of relationship with something on screen. But I imagine for you as well, wanting to chase that, building up a character within that. Do you know what your path is going to be like, or you'll just tackle it when you get to there?
I tackle it when I get to there, and I enjoy that I don't know. I think part of I not knowing is hugely destabilizing for anyone, any human. But I think I've learned to reframe it in a way that I'm like, I'd rather not know and have all the options, all the possibilities, and discover that per character, per project, and bring my own influences to those characters. And even if I am doing those more commercial roles, those more action roles, like the reef was more action, like finding a way to have my influences residing in the truth of it brings, I am the mixing pot, which I really enjoy, at least to my own eyes. Although I find it hard to watch my own work.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I mean, I find it hard to, yeah, like reading my own reviews, listening to my own interviews and stuff, but I find a path to being able to do it. Granted, very, very different. I'm not trying to compare what I do as being like being an actor, because it's very different being on screen, emotionally honest and emotionally vulnerable as well, and is really difficult. Yeah.
I think weirdly though, it's hard in, for my opinion, I sometimes find that you are a great interviewer and this is a lot of fun, but sometimes doing interviews is harder for me than acting. And no, that's a lie. All the time doing interviews is harder than acting, because doing an interview, and I'm talking about myself and my experience, that's more authentically me, versus when I'm doing a character, I can blame it on the character. I can blame anything. Anything I do is on the character. There's a law in Germany that for about, I think it's 72 hours after completing an acting role, you're not held fully 100% responsible for your actions, say if you commit a crime. It's just taken into consideration. It's not saying that you can go murder or do anything, but they just consider it in the complexity of acting that that could have influenced a particular person and their action. So it goes to show that, you know, generally we recognize that when people are acting, they're not themselves.
Yep.
So when I'm doing a character, I feel less vulnerable because I can just be in a different world and as a different person, and I can get lost in that and be as ugly or as pretty or as interesting or not interesting as I want, as I please in that moment. But then I'm going to have to come back to me. There's more judgment, there's pressure, there's expectation. I have to show up in a certain way. I have to control what I want and how I be. And then with acting, I don't. So weirdly, I feel less pressure when I get to act. As soon as the camera's rolling, all of my worries disappear and I can just do the thing. It's great.
Yeah.
I mean, it's wish good. I could do it every day.
Yeah. And look, I'm fully aware of the difficulty and the complexity of being the other person. You know, getting asked questions, like especially from, I know what it's like because you jump onto a Zoom, I'm a person you've not met before, suddenly asking you, tell me all about your trauma and stuff like that. And you're like, I didn't realize I was having a therapy session. So I'm painfully aware of what my questions do, but I'm also in a position of privilege because it's not about me, right? But it's also about making a safe space. And that's what I hope I do as an interviewer.
No,
and
you absolutely
now,
do.
Yeah. Now I'm making it about me. So here we go. But
but it should be. It should be a back and forth. You know, we're talking about something where we're finding these mixing moments of talking about humanity, about art, and like, yes, the career trajectory and like how I got into acting. They're like, and the questions, they spur these things. But I'm so fascinated when, at least when I listen to podcasts and interviews, when people are like exploring those things together, like it's so much fun, and you do that amazingly. I'm loving it.
I promise I wasn't fishing for a compliment, but part of the reason why I mention it is that this engagement with culture, it feels, certainly from Western Australian perspective, we don't engage with culture in the way that you're talking about. Like in a European perspective, we don't have that kind of connection with the arts. We like to think that we do, but we really don't. It's very surface level. And I'm curious then, as we lead to wrapping up, like that engagement with cinema, with the arts is a lot deeper than some of your contemporaries. You really sound like somebody who loves the art form of cinema and really loves what it can actually do to your psyche. What does that mean for you, like to be able to engage with it that way and explore with it in such a deep level?
What does it mean for me? That's a great question. I think with cinema, it allows me to observe life with more detail and clarity and space. And I think we don't give ourselves the opportunity to observe our own lives with space. I think it's, you know, that's what meditation is, creating a space between you and your thoughts and it being able to observe. Cinema in real time gives us space to observe, and that's a real gift. And I think what I why I dive into it and why it means so much to me is that I'm constantly searching for meaning and understanding more about why we do the things we do and the nuance of our own intentions and the subconscious and how that influences us. And having a space in cinema allows me to see it. And it's, I find it interesting when I'm doing acting practice by myself or with an acting coach, but sometimes I just set a camera up and I'll film myself doing a bit of work. I'll clean my room. I'll get dressed for the day and I'll do something and then I'll watch it back. And I'm like, oh wow, I was actually really, really rushed. I had nowhere to go today. Why did I kind of look a little anxious? Oh, when I move in that way, it looks like I'm holding on to something. And it starts to reform the way that I observe how I live and how others live. And by doing these characters and then reobserving, I have this space to feel something deeper and truer. And, you know, we have our deep, true core root emotions that we rarely are aware of. And I think that's what I'm constantly searching for. What is really at the root of the root? What the hell is going on?
Which that's a beautiful way to kind of lead into the last question, which is, you know, you're talking about being paramedic, learning that, and that's about caring and tending for the physical being, an emergency, you know, broken limb, et cetera, et cetera. And the way that you've talked about acting and being an actor is, it's a rare thing to be able to treat the skill of acting as a nourishing thing, right? You're talking about it as a way of nurturing and supporting the heart, the mind, and the body, and being able to give that gift to somebody, a stranger. You're not going to meet most of the people who are going to watch your work, right? And yet it's a gift to be able to put that on the screen, create an emotion, and then have them feel that emotion or respond to that emotion. That's a huge thing, but it's also underpinned by caring. Right. And empathy for your fellow person. And I guess, like, where does that come from? What was the kind of linchpin for you to make sure that you would care about people in such a way that you would entertain the idea of becoming a paramedic and then shifting over this way and entertain the idea of caring about people's mind through art?
Firstly, thank you. Thank you. It was really sweet. And it feels great, but it was definitely something I was, I always wanted to change and impact people for the better. You know, when I was little, I thought that, oh, I could change the world by doing this or doing this, like absolute delusion. But as I got older, I was like, oh, with paramedics, I could help someone in a moment of need and I could really make a difference to their life. I could extend their life. I could help them. And that wanting to be of service to others, I think, was just always inside of me. And then when I realized that acting, I could be of service to so many people in a way that was more meaningful because it's something that's more aligned with my values. I'd rather live a short, meaningful life than a long, disinteresting, unmeaningful life. And so, yeah, I think that I have always wanted to be in service of others and I didn't understand how that was going to manifest until I found acting because I realized the reach that acting can have and the stories that we can take part in is profoundly impactful. And so now I'm on the journey of how many stories and how many people can I impact by just showing authenticity in the human condition and allowing them space to reflect on their own lives.
Yeah, that's a beautiful way to wrap up. Thank you so much for your time. I'm really excited to see your work grow and change and progress and see where you go as an actor. It's going to be fascinating. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Also, this was one of the best interviews I've had. It was so lovely. You're really present. You ask incredibly engaging questions and it was a delight to talk about art and cinema and the root of the root, which I love and I get so excited about. So I enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to this chat with Saskia Archer about her career and her foundations as an actor. Hope you really enjoyed it. And if you want to check out other interviews and reviews, visit thecurb.com.au. I'll see you on the next one.